Okay, so I'm going to talk about supergravity from QCD amplitudes. So most of what I'll be talking about is work that was done in collaboration with Lance Dixon, of course sitting right there, Dave Dunbar, and two of our former students, Maxime Perlstein and Jill Rozowski. I'll also be talking about a number of other papers. So the basic idea of what I'll show you is that QCD and gravity are intimately linked, and that a good path for understanding the fundamental question of the ultraviolet divergences of quantum gravity are in fact by using these gluonic QCD tree amplitudes, which were described in Ed's talk. So first let me remind you about the problem of the non-renormalizability. The problem, of course, comes from the fact that gravity has a dimensionful coupling constant. So power counting immediately suggests very strongly that field theories of gravity are not renormalizable, and therefore they're not fundamental quantum theories. And in fact, this has been explicitly checked in pure Einstein gravity by an explicit two-loop calculation by Gorov and Sagnotti, and also verified by Van de Ven. Now, supergravity theories are better because they have a higher degree of symmetry, which lowers the degree of divergence, but they still appear to be non-renormalizable. And by power counting, various authors have concluded that there should in fact be a divergence at three loops. And these arguments are very believable, but these are arguments based on power counting and not on direct calculation. So you don't actually know if the coefficient of a divergence might vanish because there's some kind of a hidden symmetry or a structure. And of course, we heard in Ed's talk that there can be really amazing structures hidden in gauge theories, for example. So the basic problem of understanding being able to do a calculation to see the divergence structure of gravity is very simple. It's basically on line one, you open up your favorite source for looking up the three vertex of gravity, and it's basically a mess. There's actually about 100 terms here, but they've been written in a very compact way. There's P6 to 6 permutations and so on, so there's about 100 terms. So you can just do a little amusing calculation, a little bit of arithmetic. Consider just this one diagram. So this is a three-loop diagram. I'm just talking about one diagram, and you multiply, there's 100 terms on each vertex, and then there's 3 terms on each propagator, and just multiply it out. And you'll find that this one diagram, this one three-loop diagram that's required to determine the ultraviolet behavior, it has about 10 to the 21 terms. So you get a very strong graduate student who does a billion terms a second, and it's 20,000 years. But as I'll explain, we're actually not interested in the three-loop. Oh, we are interested in the three-loop, but we're really interested in the five loops. There, it's a little more problematic. If you do that same arithmetic, it's 10 to the 30th, which I believe is beyond the lifetime of your average graduate student. The way we're going to attack this problem is going to make use of this basic intuition, a very basic fact in string theory that you can find in your favorite textbook. And I think we have two authors here where you could look up this very simple fact that a closed string can, in a very precise way, be thought of as a product of a left mover open string times a right mover open string. And immediately that suggests that if you look at the infinite string tension limit, the low energy limit, it must be true that the states of the closed string, namely gravity states, must be in some sense a product of gauge theory states. And the theory, and even more strongly, that somehow the theory as a whole it has this product structure. So we want to make this precise. We want to make use of this. And also, it would be nice to try to understand how this works in the low energy limit, where it's really not obvious. In this talk, I'll mostly discuss this and just say a little bit about this third problem. So to make this precise, we use these Kawai-Llewellyn and Tai tree-level relations. So in in 1985, Kualuan and Tai found this really remarkable properties between closed string scattering amplitude. So this is a, for example, a 4 graviton scattering amplitude. On this side we have Yang-Mills scattering amplitudes. So these are the color-ordered, one of the color-ordered pieces that also appeared in Ed's talk, a color-ordered amplitude. And you take this Yang-Mills amplitude, you multiply it. There's different color orderings in here, the pieces that you have to multiply. And on this side comes a gravity amplitude. And the proof of this is pretty simple. If it's true in string theory, and this is proven in this paper, it's true in string theory, it must be true in field theory, because you just go to the low energy limit. And in fact, these formulas are very general. They hold for any string state. So you can put matter on this side. So any, whatever your favorite string theory, there must be relationships of this type. And also, it holds for arbitrary numbers of legs. This is all tree level that I'm talking about, by the way. So it's arbitrary numbers of legs, and you can write down an explicit formula based on what's in the Kawhi, Luan, and Tai paper. And I should mention, also, besides this working in the low energy limit, you can start adding higher dimension operators to your Lagrangian, and in fact, it continues to work. So you modify on this side by adding higher dimension operator. On this side, you also have to make an appropriate modification. In fact, the scattering amplitudes, you can show that for appropriate matches of these higher dimension operators, in fact, the same relationship holds. And in fact, this was recently shown by Niels Bohr. actually his great grandson. So one thing that's kind of neat is you can do this fairly generally in the low energy limit. So if you understand the structure of a heterotic string, immediately you know that you can put matter on this side. So it has to be, there has to be these very general factorization properties. Here you have gravity coupled to matter, and on this side you should be able to do a factorization in terms of gauge theory. So you can use this idea to write a set of Feynman rules for gravity, and if you look closely, for example, this one, you will recognize this to be the Yang-Mills, just the ordinary Yang-Mills vertex, but in a color-ordered form where the color has been removed. And I put back some global color indices over here. These are scalars. These guys represent scalars that can carry a color charge, and that would be used. You insert one of these on this side, and that can be used to create, for example, gauge bosons on that side. I'll say a little bit more about how that works. So about the Lagrangian, you should be immediately puzzled by what I'm saying if you haven't seen this before, because you look at the Einstein Lagrangian and you look at the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, and there is no way that you can say that this is true. It's certainly not obvious. And it becomes less obvious as you start adding matter or higher dimension operators, you know, in the sense that it's very general. It's not only this Lagrangian, you start adding more and more terms to it, and it's still true. And as I said, we know it's true because, in the low energy limit, we know it's true for a string theory, as proven by Kawhi, Luan, and Tai, so therefore it must be true in the low energy limit. And for these higher dimension operators, it's done by doing explicit checks to show that it actually works. So let me just say a little bit about spinner helicity. So this is all from Ed's talk. I'm just using a different notation. So we rewrite these polarization vectors in terms of these spinner inner products. This is Ed's notation here. I didn't actually put an equal sign because there's some minor normalization difference. But anyway, this notation of Ed's is completely the same up to normalization. That's an equal sign there. What's kind of neat, actually, as Ed also mentioned in his talk, for gravitons, it's exactly the same formalism. In fact, the graviton polarization tensor is just a product of the gluon polarization vectors. So there's a right here. You can see this simple factorization that a graviton can be written as a product of gluons. Now here it's kind of trivial. This is a triviality. What the Kawai-Luon and Tai formulas do for you is they take something which is, in a sense, a triviality, and they make it extremely non-trivial because the same factorization holds for the full dynamical theory. So just some simple examples how you can calculate gravity tree amplitudes. It's a little machine, namely this Kawai-Luon and Tai formula. So you do your calculations in gauge theory. So, for example, this amplitude, which also appeared in Ed's talk, is a four-gluon amplitude. Another four-gluon amplitude with the legs twisted. You can calculate it with these color-ordered Feynman rules. So it's very similar to ordinary Feynman rules, but you may notice there's actually a diagram missing. Yeah.
When you keep saying gauge theory, this is a specific gauge theory.
I mean Yang-Mills. I mean.
It's like EA cross EA?
No. It's been color ordered. You see? No, it's SUN. It's color ordered, meaning the color has been stripped away. So if you think of an open string theory, right, peel away the Chan-Payton factors, the kinematic factor that remains is completely independent of the color. And that's what this object is. So there's no color appearing in here. Okay. So you can calculate now a four-graviton amplitude by working out these gauge theory amplitudes, then multiplying them, and then you have your four-graviton answer here. And in fact, this is true. If you do the calculation the hard way, this actually is the correct answer. You can also apply this to more general cases. Like here, just a little amusing example of three gluons coupled to a graviton. And the way you do that is you take this color-ordered four-gluon amplitude and you multiply it by a three-scalar one-gluon amplitude determined by these Feynman diagrams. On this side, there's a global color factors. So this should not be thought of being associated with the gauge invariance because it just has to do with the indices associated with the scalars. But on the other side of the equation, it should be reinterpreted as the color associated with the gluons that appear on here on this side. Okay, and you can very quickly build up the some very beautiful formulas in gravity using very beautiful formulas in QCD. So Behrens, Gill, and Keif realized very quickly that you can take these Park-Taylor amplitudes, push it through KLT, clean it up some. It takes a little bit of cleaning up to get this very nice form, and you immediately have an analogy of the Park-Taylor amplitudes. That's with two minus helicities and the rest plus. For the gravity case. And in fact, you can do the same kind of ideas for gravity coupled to matter. So the key idea. It's a sum of all the momenta between this leg and that leg.
Should that double pi factor in parentheses be in the denominator?
Oh, what? No. I also didn't define n.
Yeah.
But n is the product of every single one, not just the nearest neighbor ones. Okay. So anyway, the key idea is given if you want gravity tree amplitudes, the way you get it is by doing gauge theory tree amplitudes.
So I mean, just to come back to Ed's talk, this is the reason the gravity MHE amplitudes obey differential equations is because the right hand side obey differential equations.
You mean the angles?
Yes.
Well, I guess so, but it's not completely immediately obvious from that. In other words, I think even in the MH, in the MHV case, this makes it obvious. But in the non-MHV case, I don't think it makes it completely obvious.
I wanted to talk about the gravity ultraviolet divergences. I want to lay out the plan of attack here. So the first thing is, the more supersymmetry you have, you certainly expect to have milder ultraviolet divergences. So that immediately tells you the theory you want to think about is n equals h supergravity, because that is the most promising to investigate for finiteness. The n equals h supergravity just means there's 8 times as much supersymmetry as if you had n equals 1 supergravity. Another reason for looking at n equals 8 supergravity is the more symmetry you have, the more supersymmetry, the more symmetry in a problem, it should lead to simpler calculations, assuming you have the right formalism for doing that. So the plan of attack is we start with the QCD gluon amplitudes. They'll be Park-Taylor amplitudes. We're going to use supersymmetry to complete to work out the superpartner amplitudes. That'll give us n equals 4 super Yang mills. We'll use Kawai-Llewellyn and Tai to give us n equals 8 supergravity. We'll use unitarity to then give us the loop amplitudes. From the loop amplitudes, we read off the ultraviolet divergences. So how do you get loops? How do you get loops from the trees? Well, as we all know, unitarity gives you information about the branch cuts. If you had a set of tree amplitudes, you can feed it into a phase space integral of a product of tree amplitudes, and then you do the phase space integral. That gives you an imaginary part. You can then go ahead, use dispersion relations, and you can reconstruct the functions that have logarithms or polylogarithms, the functions that have branch cuts. But actually, we're going after rational functions. We want the divergences. So it's a little bit trickier. Or you need to redo how exactly you're going to make use of unitarity. So the construction we use is the following. That what we do is we replace the phase space integral with an unrestricted loop momentum integral. And we stick back the missing Feynman propagators for those cut legs, but we are still using the on-shell conditions in here. So this is an honest-to-goodness on-shell tree amplitude. And so is this one.
Well, I don't understand what sense it makes. A4 was defined on-shell,
but on-shell. Right. Right. And the point is, you're going to be making an error in the other cuts. So you're dropping all functions. So when you're looking at this one cut, you are dropping all functions where this, in a sense, this propagator is collapsed, where there's no cut there. So,
I am constructing
a function with the right S-channel singularity all in one fell swoop. So I don't need to use dispersion relations. I'm not using dispersion relations. This is the function itself.
I don't know what A4 tree means. A4 tree was defined one shell.
Yes.
What does it mean off-shell?
Mechanically,
what formula?
It's just a naive continuation. You just continue it.
Well, I don't know how to do that. I have a function defined with I literally don't know how to do
it. It's a function which has no singularity. Oh,
I mean,
it's ambiguous.
Yes, absolutely. It is ambiguous. Right. It is ambiguous. It is ambiguous, but the ambiguity is going to be functions which have cuts in other channels.
But is there a nice
unless
function?
Unless you were to use that.
Yes.
It's not totally unambiguous because you have to make sure that you define it such a way that it doesn't introduce extra singularity.
What kind of singularities? I will just take the Park-Taylor amplitudes and stick them in here.
I don't know what that means, because to define what L1 squared and L2 squared aren't zero, you can't introduce the spinners.
No. I start with the Park-Taylor. Okay, multiply it through, clean it up. So there's now a bunch of dot products of momenta.
A Are you claiming product of the two Barkellos being written up in the Delphi?
Yes, that's right. And then an overall factor that comes out. And then the continuation, it's a naive continuation.
Can I just make yes. one comment? Where the skinners are going to remain is for the external legs, the
right.
one and the twos. Those you don't need to continue. What happens is that for L, you have opposite phase weight because they're opposite helicities on either side
right.
of the cut. So you can always
yes.
divide it in terms
that's
of
right.
Just to recapitulate this,
yeah.
what I haven't understood is the following, although it was just explained yeah. earlier, which is that although A4 does not have a sensible off-shock inhibition,
yes, for the product,
does.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
I mean, the phase,
but
the square root
gets but it is still true that it is ambiguous. And the reason why it's ambiguous is if I add in the numerator any function, let's say that's proportional to L squared, so this propagator here cancels. That extra L square introduces a function which has no cut in this channel, and I have no control of it because I'm just looking at this one channel here. So it's still ambiguous. I can add what's essentially zero, namely I add L square in here, right? And I keep L square. I just keep it. I will get a different answer than if I didn't put it in. However, that ambiguity is always going to be a function that has no cut in this channel.
Okay. So this is of course this. And this is the same as doing the dispersion relation.
It better be equivalent to it. Yes, it will. You know, better be equivalent to it. Except here, you're reconstructing both the real and imaginary parts at the same time. Okay, it's essentially the same. Yeah, yeah. There's going to be no subtraction. There'll be no subtraction because. Yes, I'm also doing the 4 minus epsilon dimensions. Now, what you have to then do is, because each cut has ambiguities in functions which have no cut in that channel, you then have to combine all the cuts. And maybe if you're interested after the talk, I can explain how that's done. But I want to emphasize that what you get here, the results you get are precisely the ones you would get from a Feynman diagram calculation. Except that I did not, there's no choice of gauge here. These are gauge invariant objects. And then one more thing is another generalization in the unitarity cuts as we go to higher loops. Okay, so here are the ordinary cuts, you know, these two particle cuts, there's three particle cuts. But then we have a notion of what we call a generalized double two-particle cut, because the idea is you want to break everything back into trees instead of like first evaluating this one loop amplitude and then plugging it into a, like here, you would evaluate the one loop amplitude and then plug it into the cuts here. It's better to just work with the tree, so there's this concept of double two-particle cuts. And whatever you do, you should not interpret this as being an imaginary part of an imaginary part, because that doesn't make sense. What it should be interpreted as is the function that you're getting here, the function that's included in here, are ones where the propagators L1, L2, L3, L4 are not canceled. So there will be cuts in those channels. You're constructing a function whose cuts, exactly. So this will have the right two particle cuts like that. And not all of them actually, but most of them. There's another cut you have to combine. Yeah, there's another cut. That's right, there's another cut. But So the claim is that in any massless quantum field theory, the on-shell tree-level S matrix elements in D dimensions, this is actually important, contain all the information for obtaining the loop contributions, systematically constructing loop contributions order by order. Another way of saying this was noted earlier by Van Eerven is that dimensional regularization eliminates subtraction ambiguities commonly present in dispersion relations. And I should mention there's a glitch if you have masses around, because you know here's a function that has no cut in any channel. So you have to think through this case with masses, which we haven't actually included in the claim, but I think that's just a minor technical glitch. But anyway, for the purpose of this talk, what's really important is now we can take the KLT tree relations, which are on shell, and turn it into loops.
Are you going to discuss doing this in all channels?
Yes. I'm not going to discuss it. I'm just going to say we did it in all channels, and here's the answer.
That's obvious, then.
I can explain afterwards mechanically how you can do a two loop.
Have to deal with double dispersion.
No double dispersion. Absolutely not. No.
Actually, a way of classifying Feynman diagrams according to their sequence.
Yeah, that's it.
In dimensional organization with no masses, there are no Feynman diagrams that are non-zero that don't have a cut somewhere. They're like these massless tadpoles on external legs. They're zero.
Lance is absolutely right. The easiest way to understand what's going on here is to think about cuts of Feynman diagrams and then showing that what we're doing is actually equivalent to building up the Feynman diagrams.
Except that you're summing all of the Feynman diagrams associated with the tree.
And there's no gauge. There's no gauge associated with the way we do things.
I said we're summing all the Feynman diagrams associated with the tree.
You see, when you take a cut of a sum of Feynman diagrams, on each side you have a gauge invariant object. Okay. So let's talk about how to do n equals 4 super Yang mills. If we can do n equals 4 super Yang mills, then we should be able to do two copies of it, which would be n equals 8 supergravity. So consider the n equals 4 super Yang mills amplitude. Now, I'm not going to show this to you, but I will just assert algebraically, and this is something that's actually quite simple to do. You start with the Park-Taylor amplitudes for the gluonic ones. Then what you do is you use the supersymmetry Ward identities to fill out the rest of them, and then you perform the sum over the n equals 4 super Yang mill state, and what you will discover is a very nice formula that the product of trees, this is an algebraic formula. This is, there's no integral here. It's an algebraic formula. The product of trees is given by the tree and then times what looks like Feynman propagators. In fact, it looks like if there's a cut here, it looks like this Feynman propagator and that Feynman propagator. And then there were the two cut propagators. That would be this one and this one. So you get a box. But notice that in the n equals 4 super Yang mills case, what happens is the tree that you get here depends only on the external state, so it factors out. So you get this really beautiful result, namely that the one loop amplitude is given by a tree times this prefactor here times a scalar one loop box integral. And then you can combine the two cuts as an S and T channel that you have to combine, but they actually give the same answer. So this function has the correct cuts in both channels, and even better, the answer is even correct. It agrees with the earlier calculation of Green, Schwartz, and Brink, who did this by the low energy limit of a string theory. But there's something really neat here. You see, tree times tree is given by a tree. So immediately you realize if tree times tree is given by a tree, you do it again and again and again. So you can go, in fact, to infinite loop order, iterating the two particle cuts. Now that's not the same as saying you've solved the theory in any sense, because it's only the two particle cuts. But you can iterate them in all sorts of directions and build up, collect information to very high loop order of what the theory looks like.
Just the ladder diagram?
No, also sideways. You can also a fellow like this is in that class, because you can build it.
All reduce the scale of the various parts.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Not quite.
Various, but not a scale. Oh, no.
Some of these.
Well, in this one, yeah, you get. That's right. In fact, in here you get some factor. If this is L1 and this is L2, you'll get some factor in there. But you can clean it up pretty quickly.
Just consider the ladder.
The ladder has no loop momentum in it. The ladder The latter, yeah, the latter is just it's just a scalar. This is just a scalar latter with no loop momentum. Yes, it does in fact regiize, and you can. Yes, yes. It's actually quite simple to extract the, and it even agrees with QCD because only the gluons contribute. So you get exactly the same behavior as in QCD in this case. Yeah, for the leading logs. No, regiizing. Not here. No.
This formula is only true for n equals 4.
Yes. Oh, yes. This formula is only true for n equals 4. I was talking about the regiizing. Okay. So let's talk about n equals 8 supergravity. So how do you do n equals 8 supergravity? Well, okay, you recycle. What you do is, in the cuts, you have products of trees. Well, trees, gravity trees, we know how to rewrite in terms of Yang-Mills trees. So you get a double product. Each one of these double products summed over the n equals 4 states, n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, which we've already essentially, well, we've done it on the last page. We know that we get back a tree. And here is, you do exactly the same thing here, except some legs are twisted around. So it's actually very trivial to evaluate it. So you get that the sum over the n equals 8 states of a gravity tree times a gravity tree is given in terms of a gravity tree times a bunch of Feynman propagators. And this is, in fact, all you need to iterate n equals 8 supergravity, the two particle cuts to all loop orders.
But this doesn't look like a scalar.
It's a sum of permutations of scalars. So this times this is one of the boxes. Yeah. Because gravity is crossing symmetric. So while the Yang-Mills case was color ordered.
Sum over all.
Right. All the permutations that contribute to this cut, and there's four of them there. Okay. So now let's. Let's say a two-loop calculation, you also need the three-particle cuts, which I won't talk about, but the idea is exactly the same. If you can do the n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, then you rewrite the gravity in terms of a sum of products of Yang-Mills cuts, and then you recycle the algebra from the Yang-Mills case to do the gravity case. And the result of this is actually written right here. This is now in terms of a coefficient, which just for amusement I wrote is the Yang-Mills. So that we're talking about gravity here, but this is the Yang-Mills tree that comes in here, and the square of it. Or it also actually is the gravity tree times some factors, I think STU, the Mandelstam variables, times a scalar double box, and then also non-planar scalar double box, and then all the permutations. And that's the answer for the gravity, n equals 8 supergravity, two loops. If you look at this integral, it's very easy now to do the power counting or see where it diverges. Well, even better, you can even calculate what the number is. The two-loop two-loop divergences start at d equals 7 in this case, which actually disagrees with the earlier expectations from superspace power counting, where they said that it should diverge in d equals 5 and 6, but we've done the
count. If I think about counterterms,
yes.
this is a higher order counterterm than I would.
Yes, this is a r to the fourth times there's some tensor in there, so it's some derivatives acting on r to the fourth.
And the lower order one that would have diverged already in 5, 6 doesn't.
It does not occur. In D equals 5 or 6, it does not occur. And that actually, when we realized this, of course, we got excited because we knew then we were on the track of understanding where the gravity divergences work. So what this provides is a concrete example where earlier superspace arguments point to a divergence which is actually not present. And of course, the way this happens the way this happens is that a symmetry was missed. And that has to do with the way the superspace, the fact there's not a n equals 8 off-shell covariant superspace. So it was done in pieces, so the symmetry is not manifest. It's actually not clear to me. I could tell you what I think was missed, but if this is live, I'm not going to say it. I'll tell you in private. I'll tell you afterwards.
You got to tell us.
No, I'll tell you at the end.
Come on.
Well, it just all this. The problem was just the supersymmetry was not manifest. Here. So you can miss. Yeah, I mean, nothing much more than that.
So in other words, the counterterm that they identified isn't really supersymmetric.
It's not that's right. I think Kelly Stahl would say it differently, but that I believe is the origin of this. And the reason why I say that is in deriving this, we use nothing but supersymmetry. This power counting result uses absolutely nothing but supersymmetry, the full n equals 8 supergravity.
So here's the details, something more about the structure of the amplitudes. What do you mean that you used only supersymmetry?
Well, in doing the sum and working this out, yes, we use the explicit formulas.
He means that by doing the cuts, yes, we're able to use the on-shell supersymmetry.
That's right.
On the amplitudes, right. Full n equals 8.
That's right.
On-shell symmetry.
That's right.
Steve?
Yes?
I don't know what you mean by n equals 8 in like 7 dimensions.
Oh, what I really mean is n equals 1 in 10 dimensions, compactified down to whatever your favorite dimension is. Yeah. So in 4 dimensions, it's n equals 8. Yes, sorry I didn't explain that. You can go on.
It just been great. Yeah. The counterterm that you do find, that's the merger.
Yes.
That is supersymmetric?
Yes, it is.
Well, it's from the calculation.
Yeah, but you might say, what is the supersymmetric completion of it?
Yeah.
I think Adesser and Seminara looked at that, I believe.
The arguments for such a counterterm are stronger than the arguments for the one that would have appeared in 5 and 6.
Excuse me?
The arguments for such a counterterm, for this counterterm,
yes,
are stronger than those that would have appeared in 5 and 6?
What do you mean by arguments? I didn't understand.
The fact that it's supersymmetric, since you don't have a manifestly supersymmetric.
No, we have everything we do is manifestly supersymmetric.
We can't, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Yeah.
It's basically some kind of superspace derivative on the
that's right.
Alpha prime Q correction. So ST
that's right.
M4 tree.
That's right.
Same thing you guys looked at as the alpha prime.
I think in a paper, right, Julia and Dunbar actually wrote down the explicit form in terms of derivatives. Okay.
So what you're finding, though, if your interpretation is correct, that what you're finding isn't that counterterms allowed by supersymmetry do not appear.
Right.
That some expressions that were previously believed to be allowed by supersymmetry are not.
Yes. In fact, I'm about to say, I will say in a minute that that's definitely true because Howe and Stahl have redone their analysis using harmonic superspace, and in fact they get exactly the same conclusion of that the first divergence of two loops should start at d equals 7. So in fact, it has to be exactly that.
There's
nothing. I think, well, the way all this stuff is done, all the power counting and superspace is done, is you just try to find a counterterm that's supersymmetric. And there's nothing about the coefficient that you, there's no information on the coefficient that you're putting in there. So if there was,
Joe's getting at is this: your mechanism, the way supersymmetry is realized in your loops, might not have allowed a chiral operator that was an integral of very few thetas times something with BPS to appear.
Mm-hmm.
So as well as only generating supersymmetric amplitudes, your calculation might also be a framework where you could prove that certain types of chiral supersymmetric amplitudes can't be generated.
I see. Okay.
Do you know what this operator is chiral? I mean, I think it is. I don't think it's an operator. Not the derivative is not.
Actually, I don't know if it's chiral. I don't know. So you can apply the same idea, as I mentioned a minute ago, two particle cuts iterate to all loop orders. So that immediately gives you, to all loop orders, you know the structure of integrals of this form, which can be obtained by just iterating two particle cuts. That does not give you all information, because actually this function, if you stare at it, you'll decide that in fact it cannot be obtained only by iterating two particle cuts. But anyway, this you can do a power counting on to any loop order. And you got a very nice formula that this class here of the iterated two particle cuts, it's finite if the loop order is less than 10 over d minus 2. And in fact, using the MHV configurations, you can actually do all particle cuts. Namely, you can do, say, a 4-particle cut or a 10-particle cut, but summing only over the MHV configurations. And of course, the reason why you can do that is you have the Park-Taylor amplitudes, and you have very nice supersymmetry Ward identities that just sweep you right through the entire multiplet associated with this MHV maximal helicity violating configuration. And in fact, that confirms this power counting formula here. But that's not a proof in the sense that you would need the entire thing. And in fact, there's also another point. You see, in this formula here is done by a power count of the result. Let's say you look at this loop integral, you count how many powers of loop momenta are caught in there. But that doesn't say anything about cancellations between integral types. And as we heard in David's talk, the ITP seminar, in fact, we do know some good examples where there can be cancellations, non-trivial arrangements between these two different integral types. So let me just say a couple more words about this, and then I'll be done. So the finiteness, here's the finiteness formula, and you can look at what it says about earlier superspace arguments. So for example, d equals 4, it was earlier said that the n equals 8 supergravity would diverge in at 3 loops, but in fact it doesn't. It diverges at 5 loops. It should diverge in 5 loops, as we're claiming. And in fact, this result was confirmed recently by Howe and Stell using harmonic superspace. So it captured, it captured more of the supersymmetry.
Harmonic superspace captures more than supersymmetry.
More of the supersymmetry. But it's actually kind of interesting. In their paper, they suggest, they certainly haven't proven, but they suggest that, in fact, the five-loop divergence may be absent. But from our point of view, for this to happen, there would have to be non-trivial cancellation between the integral types, which could happen. So the final summary is, I hope I've convinced you that this concept of gravity as product of gauge theories is something that's useful for understanding the structure of gravity theories, especially their ultraviolet behavior. The way we go from the trees, this is tree level, this product, to the loops is we make use of d-dimensional unitarity. The conclusion is, from this investigation, that the key conclusion is that n equals 8 supergravity is less divergent than previously thought. So that shows you there are, in fact, surprises that can be found. This actually is slightly misstated. It's finite up to 5 loops, at least, is what I should have said. And what's interesting is the way these QCD maximal helicity violating amplitudes were a crucial ingredient in getting this power count, being convinced that the power count is right, and also in the two-loop calculation, it's really just MHV configurations that enter into the calculation. And it's still an open question if the d equals 4, n equals 8 supergravity diverges at 5 loops and beyond. So in summary, this idea of gravity as products of gauge theories can be exploited to develop a deeper understanding of the perturbative expansions of gravity theories. One thing that would be very good to do, very helpful, would be to develop an even deeper understanding of the gauge theory tree level inputs into these types of calculations. Okay, thanks.
Interesting question of whether there is a supergravity theory that's analyzable. My impression after your talk, and correct me if I'm sure, is that, you know, if the supergravity people had done a better job to begin with, your results wouldn't have been surprising.
That's right. For that's right. For the
and both of you would have expected divergence of the parameters.
That is correct. But you have to realize that the supergravity people, for example, Hal and Stell, are now telling us that that even this is.
Why are they saying that?
I've forgotten how their argument goes, but it's. I have their paper. We can look that up afterwards. But it's not. This is not a proof. This is not the power counting proof is. That the divergence does not happen at three loops. That's fine. But this is just optimism and essentially optimism and they have some ideas, but it's certainly not a proof.
Well, Michael Green has some suspicions that you can pull out extra powers based on M theory on circles.
But these are all intuitions that would work are just restricted to five, or that would generalize to arbitrary order.
I don't think they would necessarily generalize to arbitrary order.
So the bet, the correct way to make a bet is that the
theory. I would still make the bet that way, yes. But on the other hand, I would also make a bet that there's going to be surprises here. The structure, it's very clear that there's hidden structures in this theory. You could see it in the amplitudes, in the inputs, as we heard very well, there's some very surprising and non-trivial structures. So this is not the end of the story. And these structures, even though there isn't this direct link through the Kawai-Llewellyn tie, it's pretty clear that there has to be very similar structures. Yes.
So you presented evidence for this finiteness condition.
Yes. That's right. That's right.
Is the claim that you've actually checked that this is true for all?
No, because no. The problem is that we have not done the non-MHV cuts, so you're missing pieces. So it wasn't a proof, but it certainly got. Our friends in the supergravity quite worried that there was a problem with what they had said, and they checked it, and after sufficient time they tracked down what the problem was and reformulated it, yes.
So, you explained this already, I think, but at three loops you would meet the non-MHV?
Already at three loops we would need some non-MHV pieces because let me see if I. There would be, yeah, that's right. So you would need the non-MHV pieces in it.
We actually don't expect in that case to find any new topologies through the four particle cuts, which makes it easier because you can numerically compare with an ansatz that you'd already generated through the two and three particle MHV cuts, which are simpler. You could just do consistency checks.
That's right.
What do you mean by topology?
Well, we have some expectations for which integral types appear, and I believe that none of the ones that we expect have only four particle cuts. They all have two or three particle cuts that could have been detected previously. So you only need to do confirmation, sort of along the lines of
in four loops, however, there is an irreducible. You know that there's going to be at least an irreducible topology with non-trivial three particle cuts that has no two particle cuts.
Yeah.
What's the one that is in that chart? It has a square.
I think he showed a five-loop one.
Yeah, there's even. Right. Where did I show it?
Well, that's five loops. But if you squeeze those two middle ones together and separate these vertically.
That's right. I think that's. That's right.
Separate
them. And then it won't have a.
You get rid of the last
iterated row, two particle
cut. The two columns, sorry. Get rid of the last column. Just join.
Oh. Yes.